Tom, please welcome me in joining them both. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right. This is great.
Thank you.
This is fabulous. Thank you all for coming out. We're going to have such a fun time here tonight. I want to take just a moment before we dive in to establish my bona fides for this role. As I was coming over, and especially seeing the line in the big crowd, I was reminded of a time quite a few years ago when I was the interlocutor for at another San Francisco area bookstore for John Darnielle, who's also known as the Mountain Goats. Phenomenal writer and musician. And this event was for his novel, which I had read and loved and had many thoughts about. But I was like not a big Mountain Goats fan. I didn't know much about it. And everyone else in the room spilling out onto the street emphatically was. And I was conscious the entire time of these like daggers coming at me. Because they knew. They're like, you're not a John Darnielle fan. You don't know anything about the Mountain Goats. Why do you get to sit on that chair and talk to him? What's different is that I do deserve to be in this chair because I am the world's biggest Craigmont fan. So I have standing. There's a similar kind of multifariousness here in this chair beside me, because Craig is, in addition to being a writer, a really tremendous writer, he's also a photographer, a designer, an athlete, a particular kind of athlete. It's true. And a teacher. And he does all of those things at a, I would say, pretty profoundly world-class level that's rare or maybe even unique in that combination. So my objective tonight is for us to find out how that is possible. Okay. And I want to kind of begin, not with the boring, like, well, where's the idea for this book come from question, but something a little broader. You've done a lot of things over the years. You've lived different places, gotten up to different projects. Lived here in the Bay Area for a spell, by the way. Yeah. To me, there's this most recent phase of the Craigmont cinematic universe that we're still in, and it's very much marked by two things, at least. One is the membership program that's mm-hmm. been such a great success for you, mm-hmm. and the other one is this book, Things Become Other Things. I'd be curious to hear you talk about kind of the origin, not just of like this book project, but of that phase of like your work, your life. Like what was the crucible out of which this thing that we're all in together now emerged?
Just a lot of rejection.
Really?
Honestly, yeah. Tons of rejection. By the way, this is all new to me. Robin didn't brief me on this at all tonight, so as new to you as it is to me. Yeah, well, first of all, thank you all for showing up. This is awesome. This is really cool. I was telling Robin, all you have to do is wait 20 years to do an event, and then people show up. Just do one every 20 years.
Yeah.
And the membership program, all of that came out of, just getting kind of summarily rejected by the publishing industry.
Yeah.
I mean, I spent, 20, 13, 14, 15, 16 working on another book, doing a lot of residencies, doing the Iowa Writers Workshop, doing all this other stuff, and kind of building up chops on a book that never made it anywhere.
Yeah.
And I kind of felt a little, I was talking to people and they were kind of like being very, very, laudatory and like saying, basically saying, we'll publish it at some point. Mm-hmm. Just keep coming. And then it never materialized.
Yeah. And the years are ticking by.
The years kind of
go
by. And that was pretty traumatic.
Yeah.
To be honest, it was very traumatic to kind of go through that. And then with the membership program, I had been writing this huge piece about walking in Japan. This is 2018, 2019. And I'd pitched it to a big magazine. They wanted it. They accepted it. I worked on it for like 6-7 months. And then I just got ghosted by the editor. So it was pretty terrible. So again, that was another one of these moments of, okay, what should I do? And I called up all of my friends who were journalists and writers, and I was saying, well, should I just move back? Should I move to the States? I don't know how to do this.
Yeah, I remember.
Stuff.
You were thinking about getting a normal job at that time.
Yeah, I was.
Yeah.
This is the end
wild.
Of 2018.
It's wild to imagine the counterfactual.
Because we definitely
truly.
Did a call.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I just don't think I have the chops, and I don't know how to pitch these things, and I don't know. I just didn't know what to do. I didn't, I'd never worked at a big magazine before. And everyone, to a T, was like, you have an audience.
Yeah.
Not mega giant, but you have an audience out there. And you know what you want to write about.
Yeah.
So just go for it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that was kind of it. It took about a month or two of planning and then launched Explorers Club, which then turned into Special Projects.
Yeah, renamed, yeah.
A little later.
You know, I think about that transition because it is. It's such a, it was, there's like a, almost like a, when a, you know, an electron jumps to a different energy level in an atom and there's this like emission, this emission of energy, and that transformation that you created, that kind of, this was not a following the smooth road. This was a rupture in your life. And one of the things that seems to have come out of that, you use this word a lot. This is like a core word in the Craig lexicon. Permission.
Yes, yes.
And I mean, it's interesting, right? Because like you were interested in many or all of these things in the years leading up to launching this program and then embarking pretty quickly after that on the stream of work and the writing that would become this book. But you didn't, I don't know, you didn't feel like you had permission? What is that? What was that granting of permission? And like what did that unlock?
Yeah, I mean, look, I wasn't looking for the industry to say, okay, I now knight you and you're now an official writer, yada, yada, yada. I was just looking for partners. Looking back on it now,
yeah.
I wanted partners to be able to go on this walk together with, you know, the literal and metaphorical walks. And that was what I was hungry for. I mean, as an adopted person who, you know, sort of has always felt on the outside and then choosing to live in Japan, which is also this sort of conscious choice to be like, well, I'm going to be a place that can never reject me.
Yeah, right.
All of that together. And so I was just looking for a buddy.
Yeah.
All I wanted was a buddy to like do these projects with. It sounds so sad.
So you created this virtual buddy, this virtual sort of mass of Craig fan flesh. We're all like, Craig, good work, buddy. Good work, man. Well, keep it going. But it worked. I mean, like the gambit obviously powerfully worked.
Yeah, it took a little while. I mean, launched the program and it wasn't immediately like, oh, okay, I'm a lot, there's 10,000 people paying. It's like, that. It was not like that.
Yeah.
It was quite a slow build.
Sure.
And it took me about a month to get into the mindset of, okay, what can I pull from this?
Yeah.
And permission was there.
Yeah.
And then that kicked off the Nakasendo walk that became Kisa by Kisa and all this other stuff.
There's a question that tees up for me immediately, but I want to dwell in the permission thing for just a moment and kind of maybe operationalize it for folks in the room a little bit. Because I know you're actually really passionate and quite disciplined about kind of metabolizing some of the things that you learn and experience into stuff that other people can use. Do you think, based on maybe folks you know or just your sense of other creative people in the world, do you think there's like a deficit of that permission? Do you think there's like, I mean, to put a point on, do you think there's like people in this room that maybe need permission and don't realize that they do in some sense?
Yeah, I mean, because I didn't realize that's what I was looking for either.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just so lonely to create certain creative processes and certain writing, and to have even that editor on the other side, this Random House edition, which is a massive reworking, it was, Molly, the editor at Random House, got it. She got the book. You know, we did a couple calls, and I was like, okay, this person gets it. And so I trusted her, and she just kind of went through the fine art manuscript and left 300 questions. Mm-hmm. That was how she responded to it. And then this book came from just responding to all. She's like, you don't have to respond to them all. I'm like, no, I like all these questions. This is great.
Yeah.
And just knowing she was there,
even
though we weren't on the phone every day, we weren't doing anything like that. Just knowing she was there, for me, this version, there's a quality of relaxedness. Which I think I didn't have in the other one, just because it felt so good to have that official, not official, but like someone who had done a lot of books and whose opinion was not something I had in my immediate orbit.
Yeah.
And I felt really lucky to finally have access to that.
Yeah, I mean, relaxed is an interesting word because, of course, that's sort of a form of confidence as well, that thing. It's often magnetic, right? That kind of just easy, self-assured grace, which the hungry, anxious, creative mind, like, oh my God, are people going to ignore this too? Just like the other thing and the other thing it becomes kind of like a bad smell.
Yeah, the shoulders kind of relax a little. And so when I got Molly's response with all these questions, it wasn't like, oh my God, what do I do now? It was actually really freeing. It was just exciting. I couldn't wait to get in there, respond to them all. And it was like, well, we've already done this once and I'm really proud of the thing that we made. So I don't have anything to prove with this edition.
Absolutely.
And it was a really joyful process kind of going through and
it's
and
well responding. I've had the luxury of reading the book already. I think you will find that on the page. There is a real lightness and a buoyancy. There's a paradox in there, though, too, because so much of what you've talked about is about the confidence and kind of the buoyancy of having like collaborators, whether they're distant and virtual or, you know, people like one-on-one creative relationships. But you walk alone. Yeah. The walks that form such a big part of your kind of creative and journalistic work, and the walk that is like literally the spine and the content of this book, and you are so serious about that. You're like, oh, hey, Craig, man, can I come along? And you're like, absolutely not. I think this is actually this. I wanted to kind of dwell on this point too, because I think it's really, really rich, and there's a lot in here. So why is kind of too simple a question? What is different about your brain and your imagination and your vision when you're walking one of these roads alone versus when you're walking with just one other person who's also great and smart and who you really like? What's different?
If it's one person or if it's five people, it sort of doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Just one other person changes everything.
Yeah.
And when I'm alone, there's just this other voice there that, you know, doesn't pop up otherwise.
Yeah.
Just one other person kind of kills it.
It scares it away. I sometimes think this is just bullshit theorizing. It's kind of like, be careful about your evolutionary psychology, but we have these social animal brains. I always think that if there's one other human face in your eyesight, and certainly, taking up space next to you all day, all the blood flows into that part of your brain that's watching them are they cool? Are we cool? Is this cool? And when you don't have that, I don't know, the blood flows elsewhere and you get different thoughts and you just look at things more freely, and it's amazing.
Yeah, I've talked a lot about creating sort of boring spaces, in a non-pejorative way, using the word boring. And it's
Boring for yourself.
Boring for yourself.
Yeah.
So you're not teleporting. My rules, I always talk about my walk rules, no social media, no news, no, just don't read the news, get rid of information entering, no podcasts, no music, anything that teleports you, none of that.
Yeah.
And the point being, and having one other person immediately makes it not boring.
Yeah, right.
And so the point being is you just want to be kind of bored out of your skull. Hour 4 or 5, you're on mile 20, 30 of the day, and you're just like, oh my God, this is pretty painful. I've been walking. I haven't talked to someone in 90 minutes. I haven't seen another human in 90 minutes. It's another pachinko parlor. Oh my God. And then you end up kind of hungry for those connections.
Sure.
And so then that gets me to be way more extroverted than I am.
Sure.
In my day-to-day life.
Yeah, because whereas if you were already plugged into, I keep all my analogies are chemistry for some reason. I don't even like chemistry. But it's like your ports are taken, your bonds, the covalent bonds are all kind of locked up.
Exactly.
And but we know when you're walking on your own, you're just some freaky little ion. You're ready to grab onto something. Yeah. I want to stay in the space of the walk because I have some more questions about that. But quickly, just on that point of kind of the alone brain and the bored brain and what happens there. Do you take that out and apply that wisdom in the space outside the walk? When you're editing a book or laying out a photo book at home, do you also kind of try to cultivate that space?
Yeah, very much. Well, I realized I started doing the kind of total disconnection thing about 15 years ago.
Okay.
And I wrote a little piece for Andy McMillan's The Manual.
Ah, yes.
Remember that?
Yes,
anyone
it was
remember
great.
The Manual?
It was fabulous. Yeah, nice print. Little sweet print magazine.
Sweet little
thing.
And I wrote this. He hated this piece that I wrote. He was like, this wasn't what I asked
for. Yeah, that was another long march of rejection that led us to this room. Yeah.
It was about Bob Dylan and, turning off the internet. But I started, I think, 15, 16 years ago, when I went to bed, I'd turn off the internet, and then I'd have no internet until after lunch.
Yeah.
And that experience was just so bizarre because you'd wake up and you'd have all this creative space, this boring space in the morning. And then by the time lunch would roll around, I could feel it was like my brain was a bowl of goldfish and they were like guppies and dopamine was the food. And it was like they were all at the top of the dish, give me dopamine. And then I'd open Twitter and I'd open New York Times and it'd be like, this kind of ecstatic moment. And then so I was doing that. And then I did Vipassana kind of before I started doing all the big walks.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I saw a friend invited me. He's like, hey, come to this thing at Stanford. And I went and there was 10 people in the room and Yuval Harari popped out and he gave a talk for us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was like, oh, okay, this is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just, Yuval is just laser beam man. And I was kind of looking him up after and, he does 2 months of Vipassana every year.
Wow.
And I was like, this guy's clearly has a lot of opportunities to do things. He's very busy. Obama likes his book, yada, yada, yada. Yeah. And yet he
has people who would like him to talk in those during those months.
So much talking. Yeah, yeah. And yet he just, you know, abides by, you know, carving out these 2 months and not folding.
Amazing.
And so I was like, I can do 10 days. And I did Vipassana soon after that.
Okay.
And then doing that, about the boredom, the cultivation of sort of attention, you know, and looking at the physiological things that are happening to your body, bringing your attention up and down your body, scanning your body. That plus the manual stuff, like where I was turning off the internet 15 years ago, it was kind of where things landed when I went on the first
page. Yeah, yeah, no, I get like, that. Oh, that makes sense. I didn't know that. That's interesting. There's some kind of precursors there. Staying in the space of the walk, but maybe going a little less like cerebral and more again to that athleticism. I think you know this. I think that even for as much as you've documented your walks, I think there's people in this room who virtually followed along with you with great pleasure. Even with all that, I think that the athleticism of them is like underappreciated.
Sure.
I think in a way a kind of very interesting performance art. I think of someone like Matthew Barney, who I think many people in the room will know. This is sort of the one cliche thing everybody knows, but he'd do these drawings where he was like couldn't reach the canvas, and he's a strapping muscular guy, and so the drawings are him like struggling, you know, to make a mark on the canvas. And it's like, oh, so, you know, it's like the athleticism of it. And there's something to that in the spectacle of Craig Maad spending all day walking, experiencing the world in such a vivid, deep way, having conversations with people, taking great photos, retiring to his hotel room to write a dispatch, you know, which is then immediately transmitted to thousands of people around the world. Sincere question. I'm really curious to hear the answer to this. When you think about that, what that experience is for you, the whole package, and you've turned it almost into a genre at this point. You've kind of created this thing, this event, this module you can deploy. When you're not doing it, when it's like normal Craig time, you're working on stuff, doing your taxes, you know, what is living normal life.
Yeah.
What is the feeling? Like, do you start to feel kind of itchy, and you're like, I got to get on the road?
Yeah.
Is that it? Is it muscular? Is it more calculated? What happens?
It's like there's like an edge that you feel dulling.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got to go do something.
Really?
Yeah.
And is it like up here or is it like
in here? I mean,
it's kind of
in the chest. Yeah. And it just feels like, well, you know, it's like going to the gym. It's like, oh shit, when's the last time I did a big walk?
Yeah.
You know, when's the last time I did a big pop-up or whatever, where I was really, really going for it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and this is why I shoved into February of this year, a 10-day 10-day photo journey, which I rented a car. I kind of cheated. I rented a car and drove the Key Peninsula. But I was photographing because we were trying to cover so much ground. But I was thinking about this book tour coming up, and I was thinking about this book coming out. I was just getting really, really nervous. Like, I was just like, man, this is going to be everything's going to be too meta.
Yeah.
I'm not making anything.
Yeah.
And I just started getting really nervous and itchy. And it was like,
itchy.
I gotta do something.
Yeah.
I gotta go do something.
Yeah,
and so I just, you know, I didn't have time to do this photo tour at all. I definitely didn't have time to do it. And just shoved it into the schedule and went, and I called everyone kind of in the book, a lot of the inns, a lot of the people in here. I called them, hey, I want to come. I want to go I want to photograph some pearl divers. I want to meet some of the tuna fish people. I want to meet the boat repair people. And they were just so psyched to hook me up. And I went and I would shoot some days 4 a.m., till 10 p.m.
Yeah.
Where I'm just being taken around to all these different folks and like setting up. You know, I was at a market for 6 hours one morning, just standing there basically in like one or two spots, just kind of watching the light in this market change.
Yeah.
And so end of February, shot 10 days, super intense, and all on film. This is my first like all film thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Didn't even know if I got the shots. Got the shots, thankfully, got some shots. And then spent March sequencing, laying it out, which also I didn't have time to do.
Yeah.
I was in a walk and talk with Kevin Kelly, and there were two photographers on the walk and talk, and I pulled them aside one night. I was like, all right, we have to do book sequencing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then go to print in April.
Yeah.
And then the book just went on sale today and it started shipping tomorrow.
Do you think you could go 6 months without doing one of these walks, or would it actually? I mean, I don't know why. It, like, if I was like, Craig, I'll give you $1 million not to go on
sure.
a walk. Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, that was cheesy, but it does. It's interesting to me that there's this reflexive kind of like again. You know, it's a little simplistic, but a sense of both a mental and physical therapy and and just resetting and a renewal and again. Yeah. I mean, I think there's something maybe that there's something operationalizable. God, what a word. About that too, about like, you know, people engineering those kind of those things, those energetic, I don't know, just periods for themselves.
Well, part of it too is just like knowing the richness that lies in doing these things.
Yep.
You know, it's like, you know, when I first started off, I did the Nakasendo in 2019 and walked to Kamakura to Tokyo. And already when I got to Tokyo, I was like, oh boy.
Yeah.
This is going to be hard.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to wear my pack properly.
Yeah.
My shoulders were bleeding. My feet were already starting to bleed. It's like day three.
Oh.
And I had miscalculated. Google Maps gave me all the wrong distances. Everything was off by like 25%. So I was like, oh, this will be a 30K day. And it was like a 40K day. You know,
yeah.
This was a 40K day. It was a 45, 50K day. And but I just kind of pushed through. And there was a fullness there. You know, that first one was the SNS project, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I set up an SNS system where I was using text messages kind of deploy.
Yeah.
And everyone, I would say at the end of the day, I'd send a little text message and a little photo with in the SNS thing. You sign up with your phone number and you could reply, but I couldn't see any of the replies. They all went on some database. And then at the end of the walk, I hired someone to lay out a book.
That's right.
And I didn't know how many people were signed up.
You have done so many weird things. I am just always remember it.
I didn't know how many people were signed up. I didn't know how many responses there were. And then I had this one-off blurb book waiting for me at home when I got back from the walk.
Yeah.
And that was really, really cool.
Yeah.
And that was, I was only sending a sentence each night.
Yeah.
But that felt like a lot.
Yeah, right.
It felt like a lot.
Yeah. Thinking about those, I mean, it's interesting, right? Like, so that's, I had a sort of a spectrum set up in my mind, but I, of course, didn't even know the ends of the range. I was thinking merely of the range from the kind of classic, now established Craig walk, which is kind of a meaty missive at the end of every day. Arriving really with the feel of like a loaf from the bakery, still warm. You're like, oh, Craig just touched this, you know? And it's like, it's the power of the internet, right? It's that immediacy, the directness, the sort of the looseness, and you read them there, and then they're like a little wonky sometimes, because you're like up late. And so that's one, and it's great. It's an amazing performance and an amazing sort of piece of work. And that's one end of the spectrum. In my mind, the spectrum has a lot to do with pace, the pace of production.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the improvisational nature or not. Another end of the spectrum is the book here in the room with us, which is a project of four years.
4 years that started 2 days ago.
Yeah.
Ago.
So
May 10th.
So these are, and not only the product of time, the product of incredible revision and evolution, you know, not only from manuscript to manuscript, but from edition to edition. I mean, this is real. This is a rich thing that has baked and fermented and kind of found this really, really beautiful form. So you do both these things so well, which is amazing. Like, is one for you and maybe for anyone, is one better than the other? You know, is one like the home pace and then the other is something you do some of the other time?
It's just a completely different activity. And to the point now where I have so much backlog of pop-ups. So I've got the 10 city tour, I've got the jazz tour, I've got all the Tokyo walks, I've got two Tokaido full walks that I've and I haven't touched any of that stuff.
Yeah.
And I want to make a book out of all of it.
You do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so for me, I see the next 5 books.
Sure.
And it's just having the discipline to sit down create that book. Because it's much easier, you must know how this is. You live like us. We're not going to an office.
Yeah.
And everyone just thinks you can make time all the time when you're home.
Right.
Right. So it's like, oh, you know, I'm in town. Let's hang out. Da, da, da. You know, and you do. You want to hang out. And what I love about going off on the walks is that it's like going to the office. Everyone knows I'm going to be gone.
Yeah.
I can say no to everyone and it doesn't feel bad.
That's great.
And the deadline is there and you get the work done.
I mean, that's right. That, yeah. I mean, to operationalize it. I don't know why I have I insist on bringing like the ugliest word into our into our conversation, but to operationalize it. The deadline thing, of course, for a, for that short-term project is so powerful,
yeah.
And it has been in the past for me hugely energizing and liberating as well. It, another word in the great Craig Maad lexicon, I should have a little booklet I pull out and consult, is archetype. And we're going to talk a little more about archetypes in a second, but just imagine yourself as an archetype for a moment of being a creative person in the world and a writer, perhaps offering advice to, you know, aspirants. Would you steer them kind of more in the direction of their version of the pop-up walk, or would you steer them more in the direction of like, no, you got to make something really, really rich and real and substantial?
No, everything's pop-up.
Okay.
Yeah, everything.
Okay.
Everything. Okay. It's like everything that I'm doing now came from that insight of, oh, I can use these walks.
It's the fuel.
As a platform.
Yeah, yeah.
And the deadlines.
Boy, that's great.
This is what I sort of wished I had had when I was in my 20s.
Yeah.
I think I was like pining for some kind of structure. I didn't know how to give it to myself. I was able to hack together a few projects.
Yeah.
You know, I think from the outside it looked like I was doing quite a few things.
I'm laughing because as you're talking, I was imagining the like awful content marketing version of that advice, which is like, come up with an activity that generates a pile of content, which you can then develop into multiple finished formats to use across channels. Blarg! But it's true. I mean, there's something to that, and maybe the kind of the meta version of that is like, you didn't engineer it this way. You kind of literally walked your way into it. But that kind of machine, or the engine, can just be so powerful, and you can just go forever.
I was talking today with a friend Ben here. We were talking about like, do you have a life? What was the phrase? Life.
Mission
statement for life. You know, Ben was like, you know, companies have missions. Like, why? You know, we should maybe have a mission statement for life. I was just saying, like, my mission statement, essentially, that I've figured out over the last like 6 years, is just I want to have as full a day as possible.
Yeah.
And then the next day be as full as possible, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not about okay, in 50 years what's this or 20 years. It's just like I just have a faith that if I collect enough of these full days,
mm-hmm.
they add up to something interesting.
You say that, you say that, and I believe you, mostly.
That's it.
But you've talked at the same time so compellingly about the value of books, and part of it is the kind of posterity value of books, and it's so noteworthy. I mean, again, I just to dwell in the fact that you like are such an amazing maker of images. You can do video. You have put together beautiful videos. You can make software. It's like this too is in your purview, and yet you pledge your allegiance. Here we can affirm in this temple of binding that you pledge your allegiance to the book. Why, yeah. Craig? Why? Yeah. The book of all things.
It just works.
Yeah, it does work.
It works.
Yeah.
I mean, you
the
too.
The technology.
Yeah, it's been interesting to watch Robin come around more to this like full force, 100%.
Yeah.
You're like, it really does just work. It feels weird to say everything should be about the print book, but if you do aim for the print book,
yeah,
I think it just gets the best work out of you.
I think so too.
It just does.
Yeah.
Forcing function.
Yeah, yeah. There you go.
Other,
yeah.
The other
phrase. That's in the lexicon. Yeah,
yeah.
We could come up with a good list, and it would be a good if you kind of just like meditated on all the words.
So,
you would end up pretty good.
So when I say the rich full day stuff, it's not just to part of the fullness is the doing at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So it's that walking 30, 40, 50 kilometers sometimes,
yeah.
and then spending 5 hours at night.
Yeah.
Using the mind, right?
Yeah.
Like just that's the fullness.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's not just to like do it and then throw it away. It's not. I'm not like some monk,
right?
You know, meditating in a cave.
That's what I would say. I would say some people. Not everyone is like this, but sometimes I say about writing, I'm like, I'm not doing this for my health. Like this is.
Yeah.
I want to make something, and I want people to read it.
Hopefully
a lot of people to
read
it.
For sure. Yeah. And so, you know, it's at the end of the day, having the audience out there again, the permission from members initially, and now more people who subscribe. Having that permission was the thing that would get me to sit down. It would be 11 o'clock at night. The last chapter in this book was written on the last day of this walk. And it was the longest day, and it was terrible. It was hot. I didn't have enough water. I was parched. I felt disgusting. There were flies everywhere. It was just, I walked into one kisa. I opened
the romance of the pilgrimage route. Yeah.
I opened the door to one kisa, and I looked in, and it was just like deliverance. These guys were going to shoot me and play the banjo over my body. And I was, all right, I'm not going to go in there. And I just wanted to give up on everything. And I think that day ended up being about 45, 46K. And I got to the hotel and it was 10, 11 o'clock at night. And I was like, holy shit, I have to write today's newsletter.
Yeah.
And in that, you know, but having that, again, that weird deadline, the permission, like a little bit of accountability.
Yeah, right.
And it's like, all right, let's just, whatever, let's knock it out, whatever we got. And it ended up being one of the most interesting things, I think, that I wrote on the whole walk. And again, it's just do it.
That's right.
Just do
it. That's powerful. It's not just permission. It's also kind of invitation.
Yeah.
Or as we say in my household, remember, it's not freedom from responsibility. It's freedom through responsibility.
The reward is more work.
Yeah.
Good
yeah.
work is more work.
It's right? good. I got a couple more big questions, and then we're going to do a lightning round, and then we're gonna invite questions from the room here. So if you have any, please begin to formulate them in your mind. They can be questions about Japan, walking, photography, books, Python, you know, best practices, apparently.
Flask.
Yeah. So it's the whole, full range, the whole gamut.
DigitalOcean.
I'm gonna end on a slightly more like meta and regionally situated question, but to kind of close out this arc of like you and this phase that we're in. And to go back to this word, a key Craig word, which comes up in the book in some really compelling ways, the word is archetype. I think you are well aware that through your work and your dedication and creativity and everything else, you have become an archetype for a lot of people. And I think some fraction of those are folks who are kind of like, maybe a version of you in a different timeline, and it's just the Craig that took a bunch of different turns and now finds himself probably quite profitably employed at some tech company. And it's like, yeah, okay. And they see Craig, walking and being having that sort of sovereign creativity. I think that is just so tantalizing. And of course, I think they sort of I think there might be some people in this room who sometimes feel like they're living vicariously through you. Do you think they ought to are you comfortable kind of being that archetype of like, wow, what a life, and I wish I could do those things? Do you think that's just like the wrong way of thinking about Craig Maad?
Well, I am so in imposter syndrome mode constantly.
Yeah.
Like, still, I'm not being facetious. I mean, it's like constantly just like, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know where this goes. I don't know how this thing's going to do. I don't know how any of this. Like, I didn't think, is anyone going to show up? Should I even do, this book tour thing? Honestly, that's like constantly going through my head.
Yeah.
And I kind of don't want to lose that.
Yeah.
I like that.
You can kind of protect it, kind of protect that.
And
in the
archetype corpus of crap that I've made, it's like, it's all pathological, right?
Yeah.
This is like, I'm just protecting myself.
I'm
I need my, by having the members, I can say no to stuff like this.
Sure.
Or like, I don't need this to be successful or as successful as.
Yeah.
Like, everything isn't resting on this. I know how to do the other books. I know how to do them, my way and without compromise.
Yeah.
And like, I own the systems. I own the stacks.
Yeah.
Flask.
Yeah.
DigitalOcean.
I coded it myself.
I can, the Git repository, I can move it, wherever I need it to be.
Yeah.
And, that's just completely psychotic.
Yeah, it's all twisted.
It's completely twisted.
Yeah.
But, the reason I do the board meetings for members, and when the membership started, there was you got nothing.
Yeah.
There's no members section. If you're joining today, you're getting this rich.
Yeah,
hours of video.
Sort of a library. It's like a streaming service. It's access to a really nerdy streaming service.
It's the worst streaming service in the world.
Yeah.
And it has its own search engine. It's like that's how much crap I've built in there. Thank you, Cloud Code.
Yeah.
But the board meetings in particular are just a thing I started doing because I was like, okay, there's enough people that are paying me that whatever, I'm going to take that as permission to do a board meeting.
Yeah.
And then, again, it's all selfish.
Mm-hmm.
Every 6 months I do this board meeting and it's purely just for me to keep track of myself. I wouldn't do any of this stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, does anyone here do an end of year review of your life? It's like a December 30th, and we have one person who does three people that I couldn't do any of this stuff if I was just alone.
Yeah.
And I didn't know there was an audience somewhere out there.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
I'd go on these walks. There's no way I would write 3,000-4,000 words
mm-hmm.
or edit the photos in real time.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't
mm-hmm.
do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the board meeting thing is the closest I can get to not turning into a pillar of salt because of embarrassment. of reflecting on what I've been doing, putting it in a form that maybe if people can find value in it, great.
Yeah.
And then I can, and it mainly just helps me.
I like that. That's again these multiple frames. It comes into focus. All the systems that you've built, that you have membership program, the newsletters, the walks themselves, as this kind of like exosuit to both defend your like squishy bits and to magnify your reach and your grasp and the things that you know that you're capable of doing. And I think this too. This is like a weird extra arm now. You've got the reach of a publishing house, you know, to be in bookstores, in libraries, right? I mean, that's the thing that even the most, I think we've talked about this a little bit in the past, even the most successful, I mean, really incandescently successful self-published authors, with rare exceptions, are not in public libraries, and things become other things. Is like people are adding it to their, they're like placing their hold in Libby, which is, it's really something.
It's cool.
Yeah, it's great.
Thanks to your suggestion.
I'm an evangelist.
Tell everyone to use Libby.
I'm an evangelist. I think it's quietly the most important new force in American reading.
But this thing, you know, I mean, going on the Random House journey, I kind of also, you know, a lot of you probably know how I negotiated the contract, which was I kept fine art rights.
Yeah.
You know, I was in the middle of doing my fine art edition because I thought no one wanted this edition, wanted to do this. And so when Random House finally said, hey, yeah, we love the book, we really want it, and I did a call with them, I said, that's great. I've been ghosted by so many people now. It's like, do you actually want it, or are we just having a call about maybe saying you want it? I said, because I'm ordering my paper next week for the fine art edition.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they're like, okay, hold
on.
Give us 2 days.
Great. Yeah, I like it. You're like, listen, the paper's in the truck.
The paper order is coming.
Yeah.
And I'm reserving the presses and yada, yada, yada. And then they, to their credit, they really stepped up really quickly, and we were able to nail a deal. But that was in part to, again, protect myself. Giving up the fine art rights to me wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
I want to keep that because having that independence is so critical.
Yeah.
And then who knows what happens with this, but it was like, okay, well, if we can negotiate in this way, then I'm... Again, a looseness kind of sets in, mm-hmm. where you're like, oh, I got the fine art edition, that's fine, and let's have fun with this.
Yeah.
Let's see where this goes and not put too much pressure on it.
Yeah, absolutely. It can be whatever.
It can just be.
And listen, if it's just a line of people down Haight Street in San Francisco, so be it. People ought to see you as an archetype, not specifically, because it would be foolish for someone to try to just do what you do, they would do it badly, and there might only be a market for one Craig Mott specifically. But again, the sense of like having built this utterly bespoke system that just makes so many really, really new things possible is it's exemplary. It really is a great example in a very meta sense.
Well, and the fun thing about having your own system, so a lot of what I'm doing too,
yeah,
if I just had a Substack account and a Substack newsletter, I couldn't do any of the experiments I'm doing.
No.
So the whole thing with the pop-ups is to have these things that appear and disappear, and you have to enthusiastically opt into them.
Yeah.
You know, the whole membership backend with having the video archives, and I use YouTube unlisted videos, and I have these scripts that, you know, create these beautiful layouts all of the archive of videos. I like having that clay to play with.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. It's material.
Is anyone here on The Good Place and Good Placers?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wow, okay, sweet. Yeah. So like being able to produce that.
Great. You're such a good salesman for your own stuff. You should not have to be the only salesman. Let me just affirm. Let me give the pitch. The membership, Craig's long-standing membership program really is one of the best deals in like creative all access passes in the world. Not only do you get all the content, you also get your kind of really, I would say, very vulnerable diaristic thoughts about these processes and what you're working on next and what you're thinking about, and now access to a really sweet and nourishing social network, so platform essentially, that you built yourself, and you have been so far fairly responsive to feature requests, so that's pretty good too. Okay, I'm gonna transition us into the Q&A period with a lightning round. This is just a signal that we're switching gears. The rules of the lightning round are simple, but stringent.
Okay.
You will be presented with a binary choice, and you cannot ask for clarification or quibble. You must simply choose one.
Okay?
It's very simple. Claude or ChatGPT?
Claude.
Film or digital?
Film, now.
Hardcover or paperback?
Oh, God. Paperback.
This one's a little, we're all learning a lot right now. This one's a little more like Borgesian. So there's two, and they're both, it's a mouthful. The first one is, this is the first choice. All possible knowledge about the universe, except it's only accessible via an old school BBS at 2400 baud.
Okay.
Or two, sprawling creative infrastructure at your command. Like, think a studio, tech, people, facilities, you name it.
Yeah.
Except you can only access it and interact with those people and those resources through an iPad.
Oh God. The first one.
Okay.
100%.
Right. Yeah, you're kind of a BBS guy.
1000% BBS.
Light roast or dark roast?
Oh, Robin, really? Is this really a question?
You've chosen wrong, haven't you?
Light.
Okay.
1000%.
This one.
I don't get. You're a dark guy, right?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, I am. The world's gone mad. A streaming showdown. Apple TV Plus or Max, formerly known as HBO.
HBO.
Okay.
Definitely.
Now HBO or the Criterion Channel.
Criterion. Yeah.
And now Criterion Channel or a hard drive full of torrented MKV files.
The hard drive.
Okay.
Of course the hard drive. I'll still pay for Criterion, but give me the hard drive.
Give me the hard drive, okay.
I just won't look at it.
Okay, last one.
Isn't that what we all do? We all pay for Criterion. How many times do we?
Once a month, we remember. It's sad.
You know what I love? The Criterion has, the great thing they have is they just have a 24-hour stream that's going on. They're just playing stuff. You can't fast forward it. You just hit play.
Yeah, that's nice.
I throw that up on my projector.
Wait, you don't have to pay for that? It's free?
No, you have to pay for that.
Oh, you have to pay for it. Okay.
But it's just nice to go into it and not have to choose.
That is nice.
Like which weird old French black and white movie.
Which Kurosawa film believe that you might be about to watch?
And not pick up your iPhone 15 minutes into it.
It's rough. It's even Craig. It's nice to know that even Craig succumbs. Okay, this one, the last one is bracket style. Okay. You know, kind of like tournament.
I love it. Yeah.
And so this is. Who would you rather take a walk with?
Okay.
And just the little asterisk is, it's this person, they're alive, they're in their prime, and they can walk, they can keep up with you.
Okay.
So, okay. I gotta break this. Okay. Steve Jobs or Tim Cook?
Oh, Steve Jobs.
Steve Jobs.
Tim Cook would be so boring.
Annie.
Sorry, Tim.
Annie Dillard or Robert Caro?
Annie.
Okay, wow, that was great. Okay. Yeah. Beyonce or the new Pope, Leo XIV?
Oh my God. I think I do Leo.
Okay, that's great. He seems great.
I'd have more to talk about with Leo. I don't know anything about Beyonce.
Ben Franklin or Hayao Miyazaki?
Miyazaki.
Okay, but now it gets hard.
But Miyazaki, when he was still smoking, I'd want to smoke cigarettes.
Yeah. Again, in their prime, it's all in their prime.
He quit a little.
So now we kind of narrow. So now it's Steve Jobs or Andy Dillard.
Dillard. Sorry. Okay. Sorry, Jobs.
New Pope or Hayao Miyazaki.
You know,
He's smoking.
I hear he's kind of a dickhead, so I think I'll do the Pope.
And so this is I'm sure only the fifth book event this month that has ended with the question, Annie Dillard or the new Pope.
I mean, I feel like the Pope would be a harder get, so I think I'd go with the Pope.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
I think Annie...
You could get Dillard under your own steam.
You need
the magic round to get the Pope. Okay, that's great. So, it's confirmed, me, you, the Pope, and Shahrukh Khan, that's my guess.
Okay.
We're gonna book it.
Sounds great.
That's great. I have a quote, I have a sort of an epigram I wanted to end with, because it's just the most Craig thing ever, even though this is... some folks will know this. This is William Blake, you know, poet, illustrator, printer, inventor of his own techniques. Blake, who said, "I must create a system or be enslaved by another man's. I will not reason and compare. My business is to create." And with that, let's hear it for Craig Mann. And.
Questions, so you can get mad at me if you don't get your question. Selected, so.
do you have children one day?
Do I want to have children one day? Is this an offer?
Take mine.
Is that it?
Where are you asking me if you want to have kids with me?
Yeah.
Consider it.
Yeah. No, I mean, I have a stepdaughter.
Yes.
Tyler, by the way, Tyler has been on a walk and talk, and he is the weirdest, most insane walk and talk person that you could ever possibly have. We were in the middle of Bali, in the middle of nowhere, and he was licking the trees, which I don't think you should lick the trees, random trees in Bali. He took a banana leaf, he put it down the back of his shirt, he started walking around like a Tyrannosaurus Rex, and with this giant banana leaf coming out of him, and this poor Balinesian village woman came around the corner, and Tyler goes, "Rah!" He jumps out of the bushes at this woman. She bursts into tears.
Burst
into
tears. This guy's not coming with you, me, and the Pope.
No, the guide, we had a guide, he almost pees himself. He starts laughing so hard. And Tyler ends up just hugging this poor woman, and they're both sort of crying and laughing. And, like, anyway, that's what Tyler did for 7 days nonstop. I mean, it was unreal. This guy is powered by some nuclear something. I don't know where it is. This is what you get when you ask me a weird-ass question in front of 100 people.
All right, what else we got?
What else is there?
I saw your hand up.
Yeah.
You
talk a lot about leading a very rich and full life. What are your thoughts on rest and quiet?
Sure.
And obviously, the walking is very quiet, but...
Yeah, well, I mean, most of the time I'm not walking. So most of the time there's a lot of rest baked in. But, like, this is really hard for me, this thing I'm doing right now, the 6 weeks on the road, this is a lot, and so I'm planning for the rest on the other side of it. So I kind of like to do things in little chunks, and the rest has to be baked in. And if it isn't, I tend not to do it. So I also try to rope other people in to force me to slow down a bit. But when I'm on the walks, I'm really careful about what I'm eating, how much sleep I get. Every night I make sure I'm sleeping 8 hours. Can't do it. You can't do 40 days in a row of doing that stuff without really sleeping. So I try to be cognizant of that. And I gave up alcohol essentially completely 13, 14 years ago because it got to this point where I was like, okay, well, if I have one drink, tomorrow is diminished in such a way that I can't do the work I want to do. And that was a real easy way to start saying no. And saying no in social contexts. It's like, I just have too much to do tomorrow. I have this thing to do, yada, yada, yada. So rest, I feel like there is quite a bit of rest. And, I got a big crazy massage when I was in New York by this giant dude. He was like 6'4", weighed like 300 pounds. In my mind, he weighed 300 pounds. He had like a giant, snowman, sort of like Santa Claus beard. And just, pulled all of the tension of... the toxin stuff out of me. So that's a big part of this.
Maybe this is serious. Tuck this one away. Maybe because of course this is, we don't see this, is the dark matter of your existence.
Yeah.
Maybe you should do a pop-up that's just you. I'm serious. At like a bunch of wonderful inns, hot springs and stuff, and just write with that poise and that energy about doing nothing. It'd be great.
Yeah. Could do it.
Do a lot of Japanese people follow you?
More now, yeah. I mean, I've had this weird thing happen in the last 2 years where I've done like 100 TV shows, and I have a monthly radio show in Japanese in Tokyo now. I recommended some cities for the New York Times, and one of the cities, number one that year was London, and then number two was the city I picked on their list, and they just went bananas because they're like, why is this? It's a small city up north. Like no one had ever... recommended it to be in my 23 years of living in Japan. And I went, and it was really cool. And when the New York Times said, hey, do you want to recommend somewhere? I said, oh, this place is cool. And so to have London be followed by this city in the middle of nowhere blew everyone's mind in Japan. And they wanted to know why where did this come from? What was happening? And then they found out I could speak Japanese, and then it was just this crazy flood. And so then suddenly I was on TV all over the place. And I went up to the city. The mayor's like, hey, you know, come up. You know, I'd love to talk to you. So I went up to meet the mayor. What they didn't tell me was, I thought it was just gonna be this quiet little meeting in a back room, and you know, shake hands, hey, thanks. Oh, this is cool. I like your city. Yada yada. Thanks for, you know, whatever. I go in, they open the doors, they oh, come this way, come this way. They open the doors into the meeting room, and it was like a room like this, except all of you were reporters. And it was just giant TV cameras and like paparazzi, you know, like machine gun photography and lights going off. And I was like, oh my God. For some reason, I had the foresight to put on a suit. And they lead me over to the mayor. He's sitting on like a throne, you know, and I sit next to the mayor on this weird little throne, and he gives like a 2-second speech, and he goes, all right, good luck, and then he leaves. And it's me in front of all of like Japanese media, and there's like a mic, and they line up to ask me questions. They go, Moto-san, how do we solve poverty? I'm like, you got the wrong guy. I just like your coffee. I do not know how to solve poverty. But so that triggered a sort of awareness of Moto-san.
Yeah.
And we've had a lot of fun with that. Good. I did a TV show last year with one of the most famous Japanese people on TV. He's been on TV for 50 years almost every day. And walking around with him was like walking around with John Lennon. It was just wild. I brought him to the city basically as a gift to the city. And we spent 2 days walking around. And I mean, they're just construction workers screaming to him, and like old ladies jumping up and down, crying. Oh my God, it's Tamori-san, you know. And then everyone was coming over to me. Oh, Moto-san, thank you for bringing Tamori-san to our city, you know. And it was just so, so bizarre. And then I had a Japanese edition of my book, Kisa by Kisa, come out 6 months ago. So that has given people something to read. And yeah. I'm doing book events there now. And it's just so much fun.
That's great.
Yeah. So slowly growing.
So how do you solve poverty? No,
nice.
I want to talk about kind of the phases of like your creative process. So it seems like the genesis of a lot of your work is in that solo mode where you're walking, you're taking photography. But then it seems like at the end, there's a lot of that collaborative effort. You've got the editors, you've got the folks that are actually creating the physical object. You mentally, where does most of your energy go? Do you think it's a 50-50 split? How does that work for you?
Yeah, I mean, a big push is on the pop-up. But there's a reason why I don't have the archives publicly available, just because it really does feel so fresh out of the oven. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I mean, I did the pop-up for this book 4 years ago, and it was like 30 days or something like that. And then I made this another pop-up newsletter to document, just for members, to document writing this, because I was like, okay, I'm going to do it in 3 weeks. That's my deadline. So I'm going to take everything I wrote in the pop-up, I'm going to like compress that, re-edit it, expand it, whatever, and that'll be a book, 21 days.
That's so Craig, that gonzo. Let's do it. Let's rip.
Well, because I know I'm so lazy. Fundamentally lazy. I won't do it. And that newsletter called Nightingale, I just sent out the 298th edition of 21.
Of 21.
So, of 21. So definitely more of the energy goes into the back end of putting this stuff together. And I like it, but like I said earlier too, you know, I get nervous when something new isn't being worked on. And so, you know, in February, I was like, okay, you know, this year I don't foresee my ability to do anything, just energy-wise, after this for a couple months. And I was like, I really want to get something new. I don't want this year to just be, oh, this came out, mm-hmm. Which is, whatever, that's great too. But I was like, I need something else. So, you know, this photo book was a way for me to see if I could do a book really quickly, you know, go shoot it, sequence it, have it out within 3 months. And it's been a really cool experience to do that. And I actually think I'm really proud of where this book landed. And so again, it's this thing of like, set the deadlines, hit them, and hopefully something interesting will come out the other side. Yeah.
So you had a question back over there, Matt?
You said that Zelda,
oh, yeah,
the golden cartridge,
yeah,
is like a portal to another world.
Yeah.
Subculture or something that kind of feels like a golden cartridge in the same way.
It's funny, you know, I mean, Japan came to I came to know of the existence of Japan simply from Nintendo and saying made in Japan on the cartridges.
Incredible.
You know, and it was the first, it was like, oh wow, there's this place that makes this thing that saves me and I love. And that's kind of what pushed me in that direction, weirdly. Soft power. Soft power.
That's, I mean, that is amazing.
Yeah,
it really is amazing.
It's kind of incredible, the power of soft power. It's funny because in Japan, I'm not into anything about Japan, having lived there for 25 years. I don't know anything about J-pop. The TV guy, Tamori-san, the guy I did the TV show with last year, his team emailed me, and I just ignored it because I didn't know who Tamori was. And then he emailed a mutual friend. They're like, hey, can you get Moto-san to like do this? This is so weird. He's ignoring us. So I don't know of anything that's really happening pop culture wise in Japan. I don't follow the fashion. I don't follow any of that stuff. And the thing that I do love, and that it sounds so stupid, but to live in a place where people feel taken care of. And this is what I end up talking about on all the TV shows and in the radio show and all this stuff, you know, because everyone's like, oh, Moto-san, how many bowls of soba did you eat? And like, what's the best ramen? And like, what's the greatest scone you've had? And I'm like, let me tell you about healthcare. Healthcare is awesome.
Yeah.
You guys have healthcare. It really works. And the reason why I like these small cities that I'm going to, and the reason why these people can run these weird bookshops and these weird jazz cafes is because you give them the infrastructure, the social infrastructure, to do that and have a family, have some kids, do it all without worrying about how, you know, God, if I break my arm or something bad happens, I'm going to be, you know, screwed. And there's something really powerful about that. And if you grow up in it and you live in it, you kind of can't see it. It's like the fish in the water situation. And so I've become this kind of weird interviewee where I talk about social infrastructure on national Japanese TV when they really just want to talk about how many bowls of soba I ate.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the fun subculture I'm into now is a little bit of little political.
That is, but I actually did. I've of course seen and appreciated these places as well. These like tiny, completely unlikely businesses. Someone's running a weird little cafe or just a record store, a little bookstore in like a tiny little room, and they're there 3 hours a day, 4 days a week or something. And indeed, in the context of the Bay Area and what's possible here and sort of the economics of this place, even at its best, that seems as fantastical as, you know, scenes from Zelda. You're like, oh, wow, is that some sort of mythical creature? And it is. It's like the joyousness of it and of that possibility, the kind of the flip side of that, I think, for us, especially someone in a very expensive place in the United States is very melancholy.
Well, and I think craftsmanship, like this reverence for craftsmanship in general, craft, you know, commitment to something over the long haul. You know, a lot of these kisa I go to, you know, jazz kisa, whatever, normal kisa, people have been there for 40 years, 50 years. And there's something about that consistency that's actually really inspiring. And it creates community, it creates pillars of community, it creates, there's all these second order effects that come from just someone committing to one small little business for an entire life. Mm-hmm. And that's very cool. And, the first time I became aware of living national treasures, I was invited to photograph Jiro from Jiro Dreams of Sushi this is 20 years ago. He had just gotten living national treasure status. And you go, you know, you think, oh, I'm going to go to Living National Treasure. This is going to be an amazing shop. This is going to be so cool. Then you go, and Jiro's shop is in the basement of a subway station with no windows. And you're just like, what is this? You know, and the guy has just been there. And so I roll up, and the place is empty. And he goes, oh, did you eat lunch? And I go, no, I didn't eat lunch. He goes, okay, sit down. And I get this, I'd never really eaten sushi before in my life. You know, I lived in Japan for like 5 years at that point, and I didn't like sushi. I didn't like, I ate toast. That's about all I ate in Japan, toast and ramen. And I'm like, oh my God, sushi, this is kind of gross. And Jiro, it's Jiro, he's in front of me one-on-one, and he's got like a handler who's making sure I don't kiss him or something. And it's, the way he does it is you don't get like a plate of sushi. He does one at a time, and you see him make it, and he puts it in front of you, and you use your hands, and you put the fish on your tongue. You don't put the rice on your tongue. And it was this weird masterclass in eating sushi. And I was like, it was all the grossest looking stuff too. And I was like, oh my God, I have to eat this because I can't say no. And I was like, oh, that's really good. Oh, that's really good. And I had this weird magical sushi experience. And then I shot him, took photographs of him. And then afterwards, I was with his son, who, God bless his son, you know, Jiro is 95 now, and his son is like 75. And his son has been waiting for this guy to die for 40 years.
Yeah.
He's like, come on, Dad, I want to take over now. You know, and this poor bastard. And I go, hey, that was really good. How much, like, if I came back for lunch, what would that be? And he's like, that was like $350 of sushi. And I was like, oh, my God. Ooh. Yeah, so I've never been but I should have paid more attention. So that craftsmanship, yeah, that craft thing that just kind of permeates it all is fabulous. And you feel that, and I love that. You feel that in Nintendo. I think Nintendo is a great company that embodies that as a company. And I love that they're successful, because the way they make the things they make, I think, is the best possible way to make those things.
This guy over here says you want to have kids, and I think, sorry to bring it up again.
I love it.
I mean, one of the things that stood out to me, I've been reading your newsletters for like maybe 4 years, but irregularly, I don't have my shit together, and is how measured you are about telling your own stories, how much you as Craig Maude, a active narrator who's making the scene move forward, is also like meeting out only these small pieces of your own context. How do you make choices about that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, definitely Truman Show stuff is not, I'm not into that. And even this, I mean, this, you know, it says a walking memoir. This is the very reluctant memoir. Like I did, you know, and it was kind of Random House being like, hey, look, you got to give some context. And it turned out, I don't know, I was like, oh, I have more to say about this than I thought I had to say. But I've been very guarded. And even talking about my stepdaughter, I'm, you know, very protective of that. It's, you know, this kind of bizarre, complicated relationship. She's 15, you know, and it's like 15-year-olds are just complicated in general. But it's mainly when I feel like I've talked with my therapist about something enough that I feel like it's not scary anymore. And now I can write about that. And, that's half joke, half reality. And it's just, you know, whatever feels natural along the way. Like talking about the alcohol stuff has more and more felt valuable, because I know a lot of people struggle with that. And then the small things I'm learning with my stepdaughter, talking about that, thinking about that. And then the adoption stuff has been this huge new door I'd never opened until I met my birth mother for the first time last year. She had me when she was 13, and so we met after, it was a long process to, you know, to build up whatever it was to go have that lunch. I flew to the States to just have this lunch with her, and that was such a profound meeting. You know, we sat down, she didn't know my name, she had never seen a photo of me, nothing. And I stayed anonymous the whole time we were communicating. And so she was standing in front of the restaurant, I knew everything about her, I'd Googled, you know, I'd gotten privatized, I had her divorce records, I had all this stuff. And I go, hey, I'm the guy that, you know, hey, I'm your son. And, you know, we hugged and we went into this restaurant, and, you know, she pulls out this baby photo of me. And she goes, she got it from the adoption agency, and she goes, I've been carrying this my whole life. And every year on your birthday, I think of who you've become, and I wish for your happiness, and I want you to have a family, you know. And it's just, I had created this narrative, which I talk about in this book, of my origins as being so violent, 13, that's totally non-consensual. It has, you know, there's no way, even if she, you know, if someone says it's consensual, it's not consensual. And so just coming from this place of violence and kind of pain, and then meeting her, and in real time having her reprogram that story. And also for the first time in my life, I mean, the family who adopted me did the best they could do, but I've never felt a deep connection there. They've never understood what I'm doing. You know, I never felt like they ever got me. And I'm sitting here with this woman, you know, at this booth, and listening to her tell her story. And everything she's saying is what I would have done. And it felt like for the first time in my life, I was like, this is where my brain comes from. And it was really, really affecting. And it was cool that she was so cool. She's a computer programmer.
Come on.
Self-taught. Didn't go to college. Super entrepreneurial. Just a totally, someone just hacking their way through everything and figuring it out and having complicated relationships with all sorts of, you know, different men and women and children and all this stuff. But there was this kind of pulsing curiosity. And also the voice that has been driving so much of what I do, it was just there. It was, you know, you talk about nature staring you in the face.
That's wild.
It was so bizarre. So on this podcast tour I've been doing, you know, I did an adoption podcast a couple months ago. And it's just been interesting to talk about this in public and then to get all these stories back as well. And a lot of these events, adoption people have been showing up and saying, you know, thank you and this and that. And so this is a whole other universe that I've kind of been afraid to touch. And you feel guilty, I think, as an adoptee about like dishonoring your adoptive parents. And I think that creates a lot of barriers. And this journey has been so informative. I feel like it would just be wrong to not start to reveal bits of this. So that's what I'm trying to do on this tour and in the writing.
Beautiful story, first of all. But I kind of wanted to touch on, you mentioned like your birth mother hacking her way through things. You kind of have this mentality, hacking your way through things, just do it, just do it, just do it. Do you get a sense, or do you, can you see the future where you look back and you're like, holy shit, look what I have done? Or what does like success look like for you? How do you measure that? Does it need to be measured? Like, just curious of your thoughts on that.
No, I mean, this is very, I feel super successful. I mean, I just feel this is crazy. You know, it's like the membership program funds everything. I can live an incredibly rich life on that alone. I don't feel like beholden to anyone. You know, it's like I feel like I can follow my whims. If I want to go do adoption stuff for the next year, I feel like my members are going to support that. That's such an incredible place to be. I have this, all the infrastructure set up and the relationship set up to do books uncompromisingly, exactly how I want to do them. And they make good money. And you add that all together, I mean, that's unreal to be able to do what I'm doing and have it be on a business side this functional, and then on a personal spiritual side be so rich and full. I mean, like, what, everything else is just bonus, honestly. So that, again, that's why doing the Random House thing, I'm not, there's weirdly little ego involved, just because I just feel so lucky to be doing what I'm doing already. So it's, I'm happy to feel this in real time. But this is a pretty new feeling. You know, this is the last like 3 or 4 years. It's pretty new. And it was decades, you know, all, pretty much from 15 to 38, just endless struggle. Like endless pain. Just, drinking myself into the ground because I don't know what to do. You know, not having archetypes, not having mentors, any of that stuff. It was really... It was a solid 22 years of just, you know, blacking out. I mean, I'm lucky I'm alive, honestly. I've blacked out. I've you know, in Nepal, I cracked my skull open, you know, because I blacked out. And the last night when I was in the capital of Nepal and woke up and there's just blood all coming down. I have to get on a flight. I get back to Tokyo and go immediately to the hospital, get an MRI. It's like that sort of stuff was happening pretty frequently. And so it was tumultuous. It's only been in the last, and actually the adoption stuff, started to come up because of the stepdaughter stuff, where I was like, oh, I feel like I'm such an additive force in this person's life. I should probably see if I am predisposed to stuff. So it was really about health. It wasn't about meeting my mom or whatever. And, you know, all these other things have come out of that. Like in Seattle, this book tour is also a family tour. In New York, an aunt and uncle that I met for the first time came to Rizzoli. In Seattle, my sister, who I'm going to meet for the first time, is coming to the book event. Chicago, my mom is going to be at that book event. So it's this, I had lunch with a cousin in Brooklyn. So it's been this really bizarre layering of many things on top of itself. So it all just feels, I just feel really lucky. And to have folks like you show up, I mean, it's such a good group, such cool people. So thank you.
I think that was ending.
That's perfect. Perfect narrative.